Thank you to our LIO staff and committee secretary for teleconferencing support. First up on the agenda is House Bill 96 by Representative Prox. Representative Prox and Mr. Nye, please come forward. Following that, we'll have House Bill 193, House Bill 144, and House Bill 161. So given that we have a lot of bills and basically an hour, we're going to move fast. Thank you, Representative Prox, for being here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Mike Prox, represent District 33, the North Pole Badger Road area in the interior. And with me is Riley Nye, my committee aide. So we're here to present House Bill 96, an act establishing the Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. It's relating to personal care services. And the reason we need this bill is seniors are the fastest growing demographic in the state of Alaska and are living longer lives. The state's 85 plus population is expected to increase by 500% between 2022 and 2050, of which a third will be experiencing Alzheimer's and related dementia. The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development predicts home care, a part of Alaska's continuing care continuum of care services for seniors and people with disabilities, to be the fastest growing and most in-demand occupations in the state. Moreover, Alaska faces an acute shortage of direct care workers, particularly outside of population centers. The potential provider workforce demographic, those 18 to 64, is in decline. Furthermore, low pay and lack of benefits force many caregivers out of the profession and make recruitment and retention increasingly more difficult for agencies providing in-home care services. And on a personal note, I was back in Minnesota this past weekend, and they're experiencing the same situation there. My aunt and uncle needed home care for quite a few years, and it was just interesting conversations of their children. My cousins took care of them, which was a satisfying experience. They enjoyed it in the end, but it was quite the burden. And then keeping track and trying to find the home care providers to give them a break or provide special services was challenging. So something we really need to do. We need to create strong and long-lasting home care infrastructure in Alaska, which will expand access to quality, affordable home and community-based care for seniors and people with disabilities. This will enable us to keep people in their homes and out of more costly facilities and bolster the creation of jobs. We also need to ensure that Medicaid funding for personal care services is wisely spent, with an adequate portion of the rate going to pay and benefits for direct care workers in order to help address the workforce shortage. HB 96 accomplishes both of these objectives by establishing a Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board that will investigate, advise, and develop recommendations on Medicaid rates and other policies to improve the wages, working conditions, and recruitment and retention of direct care workers. Requiring that agencies provide personal care service spend at least 70% of the total annual funding they receive from the department for personal care services on the pay and benefits of personal care assistants providing such services. And this is going to be required by Medicaid rules as well, and we have some folks with us to answer the more complicated questions. And did you want us to do a sectional?
Sure. Thank you.
Riley? For the record, Riley Nye, staff to Representative Prox. I have a sectional analysis here for version G, and I also have an explanation of changes from version I to version G, if you'd like me to go over that as well. But starting with the sectional analysis version G, Section 1 amends AS 4429 by adding new sections and various aspects of the Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. Section 4429-900 is Home Care Employment Standards Advisory Board. It establishes the Board of Home Care employment standards. Section 4429905 is the composition of the board. This section elaborates on the composition of the board, which will consist of a chair, 6 voting, and 4 non-voting members. The section clarifies how many members should be sought from each representative group or institution. The members will be appointed by the Commissioner of Health after solicitation of applications. And thus, the Commissioner of Health or the Commissioner's designee will be a non-voting member unless, in the event of a tie, the Commissioner of Labor and Workforce Development or the Commissioner's designee is also a non-voting member. 2 members representing covered providers with variance in terms, service provided, and geographical location is a voting member. Voting members. 2 members who represent direct care workers, voting members. One voting member who is an enrollee or representative of enrollees receiving coverage services, and 1 voting member who represents the Office of Rate Review from the department. A representative of the Alaska Commission on Aging or another organization that represents seniors in the state, that's a non-voting member, and a representative of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education or another organization that represents people's with disabilities in the state, and that's a non-voting member. Section 4429910, terms of office, vacancies, removal. This section explains how the members of the board appointed in 4429905, subsection 3, will serve and establish how long they shall serve and options for reappointment and how vacancies will be filled. Section 4429915 is the meetings portion. The section establishes the duty of the chair to call for meetings of the board with regularity and as needed. And they should meet at least 3 times a year and hold any additional meetings as often as necessary to accomplish its duties. And they'll provide space for public testimony. Section 4429920 is on quorum. The section clarifies that a majority of the members of the board constitute a quorum in the meeting of the board for it to transact its official business and to approve any recommendations. Section 4429925's compensation. This section refers to establish rules under 3920180 to guide compensation of members of the board through per diem and expense reimbursement. Other than that, members of the board will not receive compensation. Section 4429930 is powers and duties of the board. This section establishes the duties and powers of the board, which include advising and consulting the department on medical assistance program payment rates for covered services and payment rate adequacy for covered services, as well as investigating employment issues and concerns, including wages, working conditions, and workforce development. This section also describes state compliance with information requests and testimony and assures the board will have access to data needed to fill its responsibilities. Section 4429935 is a biennial report. It requires the board to submit a written report biennially to the commissioner. It also requires the department to take the recommendations of the board into consideration when setting rates for covered services. If the department sets a rate that differs significantly from the recommendation of the board, the commissioner shall provide written notification to the board and chair of each legislative committee having jurisdiction over health and social services. Section 4429940 is publication of reports. This section mandates the publication of the reports on July 1st each year, and the reports must be publicly accessible. And the section also elaborates on what shall be included in those reports. Section 4429945 is the definition section, and all of the relevant definitions are included in this section. Section 2 amends AS 4707045 by adding new subsections that require an agency providing personal care services to pay as compensation and benefits to employees providing personal care services at least 70% of total annual funding received by the agency for the purposes of providing those personal care services. And this is increasing to 80% by July 1st, 2030, unless the agency receives a hardship exemption from the department. And it also requires the department to establish procedures and objective criteria for granting a hardship exemption and sets alternative minimum requirements for an agency that qualifies for such an exemption. Section 3 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section establishing when the board should be appointed and that the first meeting should be held on or before October 1st, 2025. Section 4 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding new section establishing the date for preliminary internet website publication to be no later than July 1st, 2026. Section 5 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section instructing the Department of Health to amend the state plan under 4707-045 and submit for approval to the United States Department of Health and Human Services to the extent necessary. Section 6 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section that makes this act conditional on the United States Department of Health and Human Services approving amendments submitted in accordance with Section 5. Section 7 sets the day after the date on which the United States Department of Health and Human Services approves amendments to the state plan or determines that approval is not necessary under Section 6. And Section 8 sets an effective date of July 1st, 2025, except as it provided in Section 7. And that is the conclusion of the sectional analysis. And if you would like to hear the explanation of changes, I can provide that.
I think we can read that part. Thank you, Mr. Nye. Representative Sadler and Nelson got here at 4:34. I just had one question before we go to invite testimony. I'm happy to do any other member questions before I invite testimony. Representative Prox, it seems like one of the benefits of this bill is the better job we do supporting home care, the more money we save, since home care is cheaper than nursing home care from the state's fiscal perspective. Is that one of the appeals that you see in supporting a strong home care sector?
That is what appeals most to me. I don't know that we will see any money saved, total expense, if you will, but home care services are generally considerably cheaper than hospital care or nursing home care, what have you. Professional nursing care, I guess they call that, facilities.
Yep. Thank you. Do other members have questions before we go to invited testimony?
I have questions, but I can wait.
Okay. Well, we just have one person for invited testimony, and then I guess go back to questions if you prefer. Okay. Judy Jessen, if you can hear us, do you want to proceed with your testimony?
Again, thanks, Representative. Representative Fields, Representative Hall, and members of the committee, thanks so much for the opportunity to be here today to talk about HB 96. I am Judy Jessen. I'm the Senior Political and Advocacy Organizer at the Caregivers Union, SEIU 775. We represent more than 55,000 direct care workers in Alaska, Montana, and Washington. We're deeply committed to a strong and sustainable system of long-term services and supports in Alaska, and believe that HB 96 is an important bill to that end. As many of you know, our state's been experiencing a massive demographic shift that's driving up demand for care and for higher skilled care in particular. Over the last decade, Alaska has had one of the fastest growing senior populations per capita in the country, a trend that's expected to continue over the next decade. Older Alaskans and Alaskans with disabilities are living longer, which is great. However, with age comes higher acuity and much more complex care needs. Many of the caregivers we work with have children with developmental disabilities who are living far longer than they ever expected, which is fantastic. The parents are asking themselves, though, what's going to happen when I'm gone? Similarly, Alzheimer's and other dementias are also on the rise, which creates higher demand for paid and unpaid care services. Given these demographic changes, it's no surprise that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development predicts that in-home care will be one of the fastest growing and in-demand occupations in the state. At the very same time, the number of potential caregivers, which is working age adults, 18 to 64, is in decline, going from 15 in 2018 to 7 in 2030. The shortage is even more stark in rural Alaska and remote areas of Alaska. A higher concentration of older Alaskans live in Southeast and also on the peninsula than in any other part of the state. they built lives and families there, and they don't want to move to Anchorage or especially out of state in order to get the care that they need as they age. And I know no one in this room wants them to have to do that either. We certainly don't want them forced to move into institutional and congregate care settings, which can cost the state hundreds of thousands more per person per year. One Department of Health study found that care provided in the home cost 59% less than services received through intermediate care facilities for people with intellectual disabilities. Similarly, in-home care services can cost 45 to 90% less than nursing home care for seniors and people with disabilities. The workforce crisis will only get worse and far more costly for the state unless we start taking steps now to ensure we have a strong, well-trained professional direct care workforce in our state. HB 96 helps in two ways. First, it helps make sure that the state's maximizing the Medicaid personal care rate by creating a labor rate for personal care services. That is a percent of the Medicaid rate that agencies receive for PCA services that must go to direct pay and benefits for direct care workers. In a state like Alaska, where almost all personal care services are provided through a consumer-directed agency with choice model, far less of the Medicaid rate needs to go to agency overhead because the agency has way fewer responsibilities than a traditional agency model. It's the consumer, not the agency, that's responsible for recruitment, scheduling, training, hiring, and so on. So it's fair that a substantial amount of the rate, in this case, 70%, should be going to pay for services, not overhead. HB 96 would also create much more transparency around how the Medicaid personal care rate is being used. Over the past few years, caregiver after caregiver has flown to Juneau, met with members of this body, called into public testimony, all to share how the low Medicaid rate keeps their pay low and made it impossible for them to make ends meet without picking up extra jobs or juggling bills or getting into debt. This body listened and responded with multiple rate increases, two of which expressed the legislative intent that some of the rate increase go to caregiver pay and benefits. And some caregivers, like those who have unionized, got the pay raises, some as much as $2 to $4 an hour, which is a huge relief when you've only been making $16 an hour or less. Many more did not get those raises, though, and really no one knows how agencies used the rate increases, nor how much went to pay and benefits, as the legislature intended, because the information and data doesn't seem to be collected or analyzed. The department is undertaking a much needed study of how to improve the rate setting process, including for personal care services. Yet it's hard to imagine the process being effective if those doing the analysis are in the dark about how a big, substantial portion of the rate is actually being used. More transparency, such as the reporting requirements in this bill, will not only help enforce the labor rate, it also gives the department and the Office of Rate View in particular more information with which to assess the efficacy of the current rate. The second way that HB 96 strengthens the long-term care workforce is it creates a workforce standard advisory board. This board, modeled in part after similar entities in Nevada and Washington, brings stakeholders most impacted by the home care system, providers, caregivers, clients, and the Department of Health, together to identify and plan for longer-term workforce needs and assess whether the rates are adequate to meet those needs. Late summer, early fall of each year, we meet with caregivers around the state and start talking about what to prioritize in Juneau for the year ahead. And every year, topics like improved training or the possibility of decent health insurance or hours cuts comes up. Initiatives that take time require broad input and future planning. A board like the one proposed in this bill creates a vehicle for each group of stakeholders, all of whom who have unique and invaluable experience on the care system in our state, to work together to identify priorities, recommend solutions, and assess whether we're adequately resourced or need to plan ahead. The demographic changes that I referenced earlier are already underway, and the caregiver shortage is already really sorely felt. We've heard wrenching stories of caregivers needing to move their loved ones to Anchorage in order to get their care needs met, or someone quitting their job to provide unpaid care to a loved one who accesses paid services. HB 96 is an opportunity to make a different choice for Alaska, and one that will be far less costly for the state in the long term and for Alaskans who need care now or down the road. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Jessen. In addition to Ms. Jessen, Representative Prox, Mr. Nye, thank you to Tony Newman and Courtney Enright for being here and available, and Representative Clum.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And I'm not sure who can answer this, maybe Ms. Jensen. So what I'm trying to understand is there's a 70% of total funding received by an agency that has to provide personal care services. So there's a standard, but you were talking about a labor rate. Is there an actual hourly rate that they're supposed to be paying, or is it just that 70% of the money has to go to personal care services?
Go ahead, Ms. Jessen, if you would like to answer that.
Sure. The department probably has a much more detailed explanation of how these rates are set, but there are different service categories for which there are different rates, and it is an hourly rate that the state pays agencies to provide a specific service. The personal care services rate is one of the many rates that we set in the state of Alaska, and this bill talks about allocating 70% of that personal care services rate, not 70% of the total amount of money that agencies receive overall to provide care services. Important to note that the personal care services rate is one of the lower and significantly lower rates of service reimbursements or payments that they get from the state relative to something like habilitative care that's paid by the state to the agencies at a much higher rate.
Representative Clum, would you like to hear from Mr. Newman as well?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Mr. Newman, would you mind sharing any additional detail on the rates? Thank you.
This is Tony Newman. I'm the director of the Division of Senior and Disability Services. And one thing I would like to correct is something Ms. Jessen said. It's not an hourly rate. It's a 15-minute increment that the state establishes for personal care services. So she was correct. The Department of Health establishes through our Office of Rate Review Medicaid rates for a variety of services, including personal care. And the rate for personal care services in Alaska is $8.73 in 15-minute increments.
Right. That's very helpful.
Okay. Additional questions for the bill sponsor or department staff? Go ahead, Representative.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Prox. You know, my quick reading of this and the time I've had available is this creates a super board. It gives tremendous power to this members of the board to compel commissioners to whistle up before it quickly, to answer questions in person, to provide information, and if it to provide a biennial report on its recommendations, and if the commission doesn't get its recommendations implemented, it can get the OMB to write regulations to overcome any financial obligations. It requires an annual report on wage levels. It provides authority to reach into the department to get data on wages for various service groups. It requires departments to write up compelling to regulations, compelling delivery. It just gives this board tremendous power. And I'm wondering, why is this necessary? Is the department inadequate to provide this?
My understanding is that is the direction CMS is going, but Mr. Newman would have a more authoritative answer.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. So the department's interest in this bill is that the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services created a rule last year called the Medicaid Insuring Access Rule. It does a variety of things, and one of the things that it does require is the establishment of a direct, what's called an interested parties advisory group that is mirrored in this Direct Care Workforce Advisory Board. Like I said, this Medicaid Insuring Access Rule requires a variety of things that are going to be required of the state over the next 8 to 10 years. So we are working our way through that rule now. It has some variety of activities that we're staging over the next few years. But one of them is an interested parties advisory group board that is expected to analyze rates of payment for personal care and other services. It is expected that we would, by, I think, 2028 or 2030, set an adequacy rule of 80%. That is 80% of a Medicaid rate paid for personal care services needs to go out to the direct care worker. And it does establish many of the things that are called for in this bill.
And Representative Sadler, I could help answer that just a little bit. So I think Mr. Newman probably remembers the year. I think it was 2021 or 2022 when multiple legislators heard from agencies about a crisis in workforce availability. And I think our concern was if those services were to shift to nursing home care, it would be significantly more expensive for the state. So we attempted to intervene by making sure there was adequate home care workforce. After implementing that, like Ms. Jessen said, it wasn't entirely clear from all the agencies how the money was being used. And if our interest is workforce, we need to make sure that there's adequate wages to retain the workforce. And that is essentially the gap that Representative Prox's bill fills. So I've certainly observed it's, I think, like Representative Prox and Ms. Jessen says, pretty much essential to get that data. Did you have
follow-up, Representative Sadler? As I read through this and develop my questions about this, my essential thrust of my questions is going to be, is this board, as is proposed to be constituted, are all the provisions and powers and authorities necessary to achieve what CMS is asking for? Certainly, if you have a do-it-all tool that's nuclear-powered, you can get a lot done, but I don't know if we necessarily need a nuclear-powered tool to change the light bulb here. That's a comment, not a question, but I'll have more questions later.
Okay. All right, well, Representative Glum, go ahead.
Just a short comment. Yeah. Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Prox for bringing this forward. Last couple years on finance, public testimonies, these home health care workers were calling and calling and calling. They're not getting the wage they're supposed to be getting. They're being overworked, and there really didn't seem to be much oversight when I looked into it. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward. I think it's really, really needed.
Yeah, if I might follow up, I really agree with Representative Colom, and I think this is one of the most important bills that we can pass to both contain Medicaid spending long term, but also provide adequate care for our elders. So appreciate the bill being brought forward. The amendment deadline for this bill is Wednesday, April 23rd at 9 a.m. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Further questions, Representative?
We're not going to be having a session. That's a pretty. I'm going to be having amendments, and some of them might be coming in after the 23rd. I hope you accept them because this is a lot of work and a big bill, and we're going to not be having a lot of people around the next couple of days. So yeah. I want to make sure we have time to do our work here on this bill. I don't want to be jammed through quickly.
Yeah, let Co-Chair Hall and I know if you've submitted an amendment request and just hadn't come back by that deadline yet. That I don't anticipate that being a problem, but please get your requests in.
I will get my notice in that I'll have been having amendments.
Was it at 5 o'clock?
Wednesday
at 5?
I was saying Wednesday at 9.
Oh, at 9.
Yeah. Okay. Just to have your amendment submitted to Ledge Legal.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you again, Representative Prox, staff, and department staff. Next up is House Bill 193 from Representative Hall. So we'll take a brief at ease to get over to that bill. Brief at ease. Next up, House Bill 193 by Representative Hall. Thank you, Representative Hall and Mr. Walsh, for being here, and please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Fields, and thank you, Labor and Commerce Committee members. My name is Carolyn Hall. I'm representative for House District 16 in West Anchorage. We are here to present an introductory hearing on House Bill 193, which is a bill about paid parental leave. Excuse me. House Bill 193 would establish the Alaska Parental Leave Program. As the state seeks to recruit, attract, and retain young families, this policy would serve a crucial purpose, giving parents the time to bond with their child. By helping families take important time off for childbirth, adoption, or fostering, the state can ensure that parents and newborns can attend follow-up doctor's appointments, lower the risk for rehospitalization, have economic security that reduces stress on parents and children, further cement the bond between parents and an adopted child or foster youth, and help mothers re-enter the workforce after any one of these scenarios. By building off of existing infrastructure in the State Department of Labor and Workforce Development, an employee's current contributions can go towards an invaluable program that returns many benefits back to our society. Mr. Co-Chair, I would just like to share that this important work is a continuation of my predecessor, former Representative Jenny Armstrong, and we've received also some support from Representative Elise Galvin with the previous work that she has done offline as well. So with that, if it's okay with Co-Chair Fields, I'd like to turn it over to my very capable Chief of Staff, Tristan Walsh.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. So we'll walk folks through the PowerPoint, and I will try to be brief given the agenda tonight, but also I'm happy to answer any questions that members have. A refresher of where we are today. Currently, the state of Alaska has only effectively unpaid absence. In 2019, President Trump passed the National Defense Authorization Act, which extended paid parental leave to federal employees. That was also already a benefit available to members of the military. So effectively, there is no federal policy regarding non-public employees at the federal level, and this becomes a state policy that the legislature could pursue. One of the facts that was especially striking is when we look at the absence of paid leave or paid parental leave, is that 23% of mothers in the United States return to work within 10 days of giving birth. And almost always, this is due to the financial burden on the household. And so this is against most doctor's orders, if this was the case, and oftentimes puts them in really dire straits when trying to obtain infant care. So one of the charts that the committee is likely seen in other committees in this body is the Heckman equation. Effectively, the early investments by society into a childhood, into a child's first 3 years of life have extraordinary return on investment in that citizen's social emotional well-being and higher outcomes in life. They're less likely to be dependent on drugs. They're more likely to have very high social emotional skills that help them navigate all the complexities of life. And when you look at a policy such as that lined out in this bill, that is where, you know, bonding with their parents is a really transformative, important first step. So this is a brief overview of some of the impacts that paid parental leave can have on the health of parents. And so women who take paid leave have a 50% reduction in the odds of being rehospitalized within 20 months of giving birth. They're able to make doctor's appointments. Their children are able to also be in those doctor's appointments. It has a massive impact on the reduction in stress for new mothers. They're less likely to have postpartum depression, and it can address maternal health disparities for various populations in our society. A fun fact is fathers who also take paid leave are also more likely to live longer.
Jump in with a question here, and please jump in, Representative Colum, if you have questions. I was wondering if you all could ask the department for an estimate on savings. I don't know if we have an average cost of hospitalization postpartum, but what is at least a rough estimate of savings if we were to achieve in the state of Alaska a 51% reduction in hospitalization based on the percentage of women on Medicaid for birth? And I don't expect you all to have that this time, but that would be a good number to have for the future. Thank you.
Be happy to. Thank you. So when it comes to the impact at large for paid parental leave, most of those folks who are employed in the United States do not have access to paid leave. And so that's about 75% of Alaskans, which is roughly 270,000 workers. And even unpaid leave, so that's job protected absence, is often inaccessible for many Alaskans. And the National Partnership for Women and Families estimates that if women in Alaska were able to participate in the labor force the same way they do in countries with this sort of national policy, then there'd be an estimated 8,000 more additional workers in our state and approximately $300 million more in wages earned statewide. And just for a high-level overview, you know, women make up 47% of our total workforce, and 28% of business owners are women. And on top of that, when we look at some of the stresses placed on our services such as SNAP or public assistance, access to a program like paid leave can also reduce a person's reliance on that as they try to maintain their household in the months after adoption, fostering, or childbirth. So in terms of the impact for businesses, there's significant gains for companies that take up these policies. And so in states like New York, the creation of a paid leave program created a structure that helped them effectively predict and manage long absences. And then 2/3 of that reported that they were able to manage that relatively well, and or they actually saw reductions in per worker labor costs, because one of the biggest factors is that it lets small businesses compete with large companies that are more likely to offer this program. You're also more likely to have that employee re-enter the workforce, which I'll show in the next slide, has a significant savings in terms of recruitment and retention. And then on top of that, the final bullet here is, I think, really notable. This is where folks who are able to maintain paid leave essentially can return to the workforce and are less likely to pay a penalty essentially for maternity leave or paternity leave. And so this is where your accrual, your ability to advance in the workplace, those are very important metrics that often people have to make choices between advancing or advancing their career or taking care of a family member.
Can you go back to that last slide? So I just want to flag one of the primary drivers of the gender wage gap in Alaska is moms who temporarily drop out of the labor force to take care of kids, and then when they return, they never achieve what would have otherwise been regular salary increments. So I know the Department of Labor did some research on this a few years back, and I think maybe getting an update on that would be useful. I don't know if Mr. Weller and Paloma Harbor are here from the department, and I might ask them to just follow up on helping us understand how women dropping out of the workforce increases the gender wage gap and decreases lifetime earnings. And sorry to interrupt, but thanks to the department for being here.
This is a continuation of some of the business impacts of policy such as this. Like I said earlier, it is estimated that the cost of employee turnover to recruit, retain, or to find a new worker can cost 23.5%, and then it can go as high as 150% as vacancies go on. So businesses pay production costs, and they also pay a penalty in, like, lost opportunity. Studies have found that those firms that implement these policies have greater revenue and profit per full-time equivalent employee. And so you could think of it as an investment in their workforce. And so technology companies surveyed found a return of $2.64 for every $1 they invested in this policy. And then the same thing for manufacturers. They should see a return of $2.57 for every dollar invested. And that can be found in higher worker productivity, higher worker satisfaction with their workplace. They're 22% more likely to recommend their job to a friend who doesn't have access to this policy. And when you look at demographics such as Generation Z, when they're considering relocating for a job opportunity, they have stated in polling that one of the number one things they look at is whether or not there is a policy such as paid family leave or paid parental leave. And this is a bit of a very high overview of the landscape that the nation is in, absent a federal policy. It's being pursued by all states. This is from MetLife. They are one of the providers for a different type of policy that covers this. And so you can see that 14, I think, have – actually, let me refer to my notes real quick. I had this in my notes line. So last year, 199 bills were filed in 36 states. Three of them passed bills such as Kentucky, Tennessee, and South Carolina. And then 17 states were considering expansions to their own existing programs. And so it's kind of a constantly changing environment, but this was the map as of January 15th. So now we'll kind of transition to the bill before you. This model is based on a model policy that looks at unemployment insurance. And so as a background for unemployment insurance, it was established in 1935 by President Roosevelt in the Social Security Act. And it is essentially wage replacement for when you're unemployed and looking for work. There are other products that the state operates, such as short-term disability. But that has limited applications when you're looking at parental leave or bonding leave. It's usually only covers complications from pregnancy. And so for almost 100 years, employers are familiar with the processes to deduct the conduct the deductions, conduct the tax withholding for the federal government and for the state. And so this is a familiar infrastructure for most employers. Alaska is unique in that not many states have an actual employee contribution, and this is something that this committee has heard before, that it does not necessarily have to go to the UI Trust Fund if the legislature were to commit to a different policy. And so the HB 193 would establish a separate fund where that contribution that we'll get to in the next slide here is withheld for the collection of a parental leave claim. And it also conducts a technical tweet that was highlighted in the August 2024 Labor Trends magazine that had suggested that originally the legislative intent or the policy of the state should be at least 50% of wage replacement for the qualifying base period. And so that was something that had lagged over time with inflation. And so it was unique in that these were numbers that were out of step with the rest of the unemployment insurance program. This is a flow chart that was a coworker in Rep. Field's office helped us make. And this essentially takes the same chart that the Department of Labor gave to y'all a month or so ago. And we just tweaked it to show the policy path envisioned by the bill. And so essentially what you have is the unemployment insurance tax collected on the left. And you see that there's an employee contribution. The employee contribution is bifurcated. 0.35% is in statute and goes towards STEP and TVAP. And so this committee has heard quite a bit about that. The remainder, 0.15%, is what currently goes into the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. And per legislative legal and the Department of Labor, that is what can be diverted towards something like a paid leave fund. And it's important to note the employer tax rate here is held harmless and will continue to be sending funds to the state and federal government under federal law.
Could we pause here for a second? So could I just ask, I assume that you consulted with the Department of Labor to ensure that the employer contribution would be sufficient to maintain robustness and solvency of the UI Trust Fund as proposed in this bill?
For the record, through the chair, we did have a conversation that, and I could let Mr. Weller and the department speak to it if the committee chose. But we also have more modeling coming that hopefully will be available next week.
Okay. Maybe just proceed then. Thank you.
This is another slide showing a hypothetical employee who would have currently under under the current statute, this would be the max amount of taxable wage that the department would look at. And so of that hypothetical employee, what would be collected by the department is, and this, again, this is from the department's own flow chart that you all had seen a month or so ago, the raw dollars collected there on the left, and then you can see the amount representing the employee portion, the amount representing the employer portion. You see what is designated funds for STEP and TVAP, and then the remainder is approximately $77 would be what is going into the paid leave account. And so the bill at present, this represents more or less what are the main levers when it comes to the policy choices the body could consider, is essentially when operating a paid leave account or paid leave program, the benefit duration, the benefit amount, that is how much of wages are replaced, the contribution rate, and then eligible uses. And that's our presentation. We'd be happy to take questions.
Great. Do members have questions for the bill sponsor, staff, or Lynn and Weller, or Paloma Harbor?
I have a question.
Go ahead, Representative Paloma.
Thank you, Chair Fields. So I did a lot of digging around this money, this extra employee money, and made an amendment towards the budget on that. So I know it's available. One of the things that I discovered, though, I got a legal memo saying that the feds actually look at employer and employee contributions the same and that it could cause a problem. I'm just wondering if that's been researched at all, because that's not something we want to get going and then get shut down. That's a disaster. So I just didn't know if you had looked around that issue.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall. We did not get that memo, but what we can do is Allison Radford, our drafter, is available, and she's listening, so we could also have her speak to that if you'd like.
Sure. Go ahead, Ms. Radford.
For the record, just Mall staff representative Fields or Hall. She might have to call in real quick.
Oh, okay. Let's take a brief at...
I can wait.
Well, actually, tell you what. We'll see if we can get Ms. Radford online. In the meantime, are there other questions for the bill sponsor? Well, Ms. Winghire is about to leave. I forgot to thank her for also reviewing the previous iteration of this bill over the interim. Do members have additional questions for Representative Hall or Tristan Walsh at this time? Okay, so we will be bringing this bill back next week with additional modeling for committee members to consider. Is that the plan?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Hall, that is the plan.
Okay. All right. Well, in the interest of time, if members don't have further questions right now, I think why don't we go on to the next bill in the queue. Representative Ruffridge, please come up, and while you come up, we'll take a brief at ease. Record, and while Representative Ruffridge gets queued up, Allison Radford, if you heard Representative Colom's question, could you just confirm that it is appropriate for us to divert a portion of the employee contribution for unemployment benefits into a parental leave fund? Thank you.
Yes, hello. For the record, this is Allison Radford from Legislative Legal Services. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Could you please repeat the question?
Representative Colom is going to repeat the question.
Yes, so can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you better now. Thank you.
Great. Hi. So I'm just asking, I had gotten a legal memo about this fund that the feds consider employer and employee contributions the same with the same restrictions, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts were on that, if there might be a legal issue down the line.
Yes, again, for the record, Allison Radford, Legal Services, through the chair to Representative Colom. Once a state collects funds for the purposes of unemployment insurance, that money is considered part of the unemployment fund and then has to be used in accordance with federal law. That is correct. What we're doing here is somewhat different in this bill, in that there's actual, and this is the same mechanism that funds both STEP and the vocational educational fund, is that an additional special contribution is added to the, and is collected in the same manner as unemployment insurance contributions from the employee, and then the same amount is credited back to the employee against their unemployment insurance burden. So it's a invisible contribution to the employee, but in that way it's a different contribution. It's collected and then deposited it into a separate fund, so it's not collected for the purpose of unemployment insurance.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Radford, and thank you, Representative Colom. Okay, Now we're on to House Bill 144, prior authorization. Thank you, Representative Ruffridge, and excellent for being here.
Yes, thank you, Chair Fields and members of Labor and Commerce. Certainly appreciate taking the time today to hear House Bill 144 dealing with prior authorizations. I will certainly just state for the record, my name is Representative Ruffridge from District 7. I'm joined by my Chief of Staff, Mr. Sexton, and he will be going over a bill presentation as well as certainly going through a sectional if that is the desire of the Chair. Just as a way of introduction, prior authorizations, if you have not seen or heard from this particular issue in the past, this is where either care for services or medications or other devices for medical care are required to be approved by the payer before you either receive those services or take care of those medications being delivered. And so this is has been, in many cases, a barrier for individuals to receive care due to a whole bunch of constraints, both technology constraints as well as constraints of old equipment and other sorts of things. So this was a bill that was brought forward in the previous legislative session and talked about in many ways in regards to a program called Gold Carding. That did not end up seeing the finish line, and as a result, throughout the interim, working with a lot of stakeholders and individuals involved from both the hospital association as well as payer groups, what you see before you is a collaborative effort to address the prior authorization situation in this state, try to adapt some timelines that people can have access to care that is needed, both on an expedited fashion and potentially even further expedited if it's an emergency situation. It also addresses issues with chronic care as well as updating some of the requirements for response times if there is issues that need to be addressed with a potential rejection of a prior authorization. This is designed to be good for patients, improve access to care, and I will leave it to Mr. Sexton to go through the details and then stand ready for questions. We do have Mr. Kosin online, as well as Mr. Stranigan from Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield, Mr. Kosin from AHA. So I will let Mr. Sexton proceed.
For the record, Bud Sexton, staff to Representative Ruffridge. So we'll briefly go through this presentation, and if you have any questions, we can stop. So again, just restating, prior authorization is necessary for obtaining services. An issue which this bill looks to address is the time component. Previously, it's taken up at least 5 days, and also excluding weekends, so this bill does correct that. Individuals with chronic conditions have experienced significant difficulty with previous prior authorizations. Again, we'll talk about that a little bit further. Over the past years, as was mentioned, a lot of meetings, really looking at a collaborative effort to find out some timelines and other components that would be able to be addressed. The goal here is to have an easy to understand process, making sure there's timelines that everyone is aware of, and then also establish an enforcement mechanism for the Director of Insurance. Reasonable and efficient process. We're looking for 72 hours for a standard request and 24 hours for an expedited request. And another key item in this, if a timeline is not met, it's considered to be approved. So that's a definite benefit to the patients. If more information is necessary in order to be able to make a determination, this bill does establish the timelines for when that needs to be accomplished. This bill also addresses where prior authorizations shall live, and if it's on a insurer, if they have a website, shall be listed there. If they have a portal, it shall be listed there. If they have both locations, well, then we want it to be placed on both. And prior authorizations make sure that it is peer-reviewed, evidence-based, clinical reviews, and also making sure that all sources, including utilization review organizations, make sure everyone applies the standards of prior authorizations consistently. As we all know, sometimes there may be a difference between what the insurer may have on their website or the utilization review organization. So if there is a difference, the patient will benefit of that. So whichever facet is most beneficial to the patient will survive. And again, kind of the tie, instead of in baseball, as a tie goes to the runner, well, in this case, the patients benefit. If a prior authorization process is necessary, and again, also on that website, the dates that requirement became effective, so there are no gotchas. Chronic conditions, it's something that is ongoing, obviously, for these patients. This establishes that a chronic condition is valid for not less than 12 months, and it does provide an automatic renewal process if the condition, if everything stays the same. And again, for many of these patients, this is an ongoing situation, and so yes, it would definitely stay the same. So this provides for that situation. And we will address a little bit further about talking about the stage 4 metastatic cancer and the step therapy. Director of insurance gives authority to monitor compliance and examination at least every 2 years, making sure timelines, adherence, everything is complete, and both the utilization review organizations and third-party administrators. And it does give the director the ability to impose penalties if there is non-compliance. And if there are more severe violations, that does give the ability for that. Mr. Chair. I do also have a sectional that I can abbreviate through if you desire.
I'm actually fine skipping a reading of the sectional if other committee members are, and we can proceed with invited testimony. Does that work for you, Representative Ruffridge?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do members have questions for the bill sponsor at this time? If not, we'll do invited testimony that might answer some questions. Okay. Let's go to Jared Cosin. Thank you, Mr. Cosin, for being here, and please proceed with invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure, before I get started, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Wonderful. For the record, my name is Jared Cosin. I am the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. And I want to thank Representative Ruffridge for bringing House Bill 144 forward. And I want to thank both the chairs and all committee members for hearing it today. The Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association strongly supports House Bill 144, which seeks to reform the prior authorization process. Prior authorization is a useful process for reviewing appropriateness of medical care, but it's also a flawed process that can and has led to excruciating delays to patient care. We all recognize, anyone who touches this process recognizes that it should, can and should function better, and that's what House Bill 144 is all about. It's a collaboration amongst providers, insurers, and regulators to improve this process for patients. And I know we just went through the sectional, but I just want to highlight the improvements for patients include speeding up those decisions, turnaround times from 5 working days to 72 hours. That includes providing long-term approvals for chronic conditions. It means not allowing restrictions on those key therapies for stage 4 cancer and requiring an exception process to step therapy protocols. This bill creates an enormous amount of transparency around the processes that are used, how they're used, when they're effective, who are doing these reviews, how they're going to be, how accountability is going to be applied, and ultimately how this bill is going to be enforced. And the bill also does a nice job of prioritizing automation. In closing, this is a comprehensive bill. Got the strong backing of hospitals through the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, physicians through the Alaska State Medical Association, and all the insurers in our state, especially our larger insurers, Premier Blue Cross and Nota Health. I again want to thank Representative Ruffridge. I want to thank the committee today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Cosin? Seeing none at this time, next up in invite testimony is Gary Stranigan. Mr. Stranigan, please proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Stranigan here for Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, testifying in support of House Bill 144. And I'd like to echo Mr. Cosin's thanks to Representative Ruffridge for sponsoring the bill and to the committee for hearing it. Primera is a nonprofit health plan serving Alaskans since before statehood. We feel that efforts to promote the affordability of our products are key to continuing to be able to provide care for our customers. This is because affordability has become a gateway of sorts, restricting access to health care. Prior authorization is an important component of affordability because it helps us verify that our members are getting the right care at the right time, in the right setting, and at the right price. We wanted to be sure that the compromise in front of you maintained the ability of health plans to use prior auth with affordability in mind, but with some reasonable sideboards as well as incentives that will help plans modernize and improve their prior auth systems so that they best serve providers, plans, and patients alike, most importantly. Primera engaged extensively in the efforts to negotiate a workable bill on this topic, and we commend House Bill 144 to you as it represents a set of reasonable compromises made by all parties. Thank you, and please pass House Bill 144.
Okay. Questions for the invited testifiers? Questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. We will return to House Bill 144 on Wednesday and take public testimony at that time. Thank you, Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is House Bill 161 by Representative Ruffridge. Representative Ruffridge, would you like to begin your public testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee once again. This is my pleasure to introduce to this committee House Bill 161. For the record, my name is Justin Ruffridge, representative for District 7. I am pleased to be joined with Representative Colom as well as a sponsor of this bill, and certainly this has been a topic by which I think I've experienced a lot of interest from small businesses and chambers of commerce across the state, and you'll hear from them in invited testimony. Also joined by Mr. Sexton, once again, my chief of staff, who will go over a brief presentation, very brief, going over some of the key items of this bill. Before he does that, though, as a way of introduction, when ballot measure 1 passed, which that happened just in November, I think there was some concern, particularly from the small business community across the state of Alaska, about how this was going to affect them. And as a small business owner myself, this was certainly risen to the top of my radar. This bill in no way seeks to repeal or change some of the key provisions of ballot measure 1, most notably the increase to minimum wage, which I think broadly supported across the state of Alaska by the voters, but does seek to alter some of the sections, I think, that may have been less aware amongst the electorate, which was the changes to sick leave exemptions or sick leave, paid sick leave requirements for businesses. And so this bill seeks to adjust or make essentially what I would call a committee substitute to ballot measure 1 with some very small changes to those things that may give some relief to small businesses that really, I think, would be helpful in their approach to doing business in the state. So I will turn it over to Mr. Sexton for the presentation, and then we can certainly go to invited testimony after that.
For the record, Bud Sexton, staff to Representative Ruffridge. So in a nutshell, this one slide basically encapsulates all the different changes that we're looking to make with House Bill 161. And you'll see across the top there on the in the middle column is ballot measure 1, and then in the top right column, House Bill 161. So be able to see exactly where the changes are located. And so in the first one, we're talking about the number of employees. And in the first two lines, basically the quickest way to understand it is instead of 15 or less employees or 15 or more employees, as far as the leave accruals, House Bill 161 looks to apply that to businesses with 50 or more employees. For a leave cash out, 161 puts in language in there which allows an employer may, at the employee's request, to be allow the employee to exchange the accrued sick leave for cash value. Notification to the employer. And ballot measure one, there was no requirement for the employee to be able to make a good faith effort to notify the employer before the beginning of their workday or when they look to use the paid sick leave that they have accrued. So this puts in just some the requirement to make sure that employee does make that good faith effort before the start of the workday. And 161 also puts in an exemption for seasonal workers for that sick leave. As we know, Alaska has a strong seasonal workforce, whether it's in wintertime or summertime. This bill, 161, has broad support from all the different entities listed here. Again, what we're really looking for is to enable the small businesses in Alaska to be able to thrive and look how to take best of their employees. Mr. Chair.
Questions? Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you for presenting the bill today. I liked the columns of ballot measure 1 versus HB 161 changes. It's a good summary. Can you also potentially add a column or speak to pre-ballot measure 1, and how does HB 161 compare? Are we walking back those provisions of ballot measure 1 to prior law, or is this new?
Thank you. Through the chair, prior to ballot measure 1, there was no requirements in law for everything that you see in ballot measure 1 was essentially new. So House Bill 161 seeks to, because of our constitutional requirement to allow a ballot measure to not be repealed, essentially, until 2 years have been elapsed. House Bill 161 does allow us to essentially amend a ballot measure, which is constitutional. And so there is no way to go back to what I think your question is, what was there previously. Your only option with a House bill or a Senate bill is to amend a previous ballot measure. So it does not return. It would be unconstitutional to return it to what it was previously.
We have to take a brief at ease. On the record, so the meeting is still being recorded. Please proceed with invited testimony. All the testifiers got dropped. We'll see if that can get resolved. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Fields. I was done.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
You're okay.
I think that was the whole question.
Okay. Representative Klum, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Fields. So I just wanted to add some remarks to this because this is an important bill for me and for my district. So when I was made aware of ballot measure 1, I actually walked my businesses in my district with the ballot proposition in my hand. Most of the small businesses were aware there was some kind of minimum wage on the ballot. They did not know anything about the paid sick leave or the other section. Out of all the businesses in my district, there was only one that was totally aware, and that was Fred Meyer. And so maybe if you're a big corporation, you can do something like this, you can absorb the changes. But it was clear that in my district and many businesses across Anchorage that they felt like this was going to really drown them. And when I say that is that what will happen if we don't try to amend this a little bit and make the language a little cleaner and make it more adaptable to small businesses, we have small businesses that might actually just go out of business. For sure, we're going to be losing workers because they can't afford it, and they will be increasing prices. I mean, even if you go down to a coffee shop down here in downtown Juneau, they have a flyer in their door saying they're increasing prices because of ballot measure 1. And so because the requirement that there's no way to repeal it for 2 years, we do have some leeway to amend the ballot measure. Representative Ruffridge and I worked together with Ledge Legal to make sure we were in those parameters, that we weren't changing the intent of the ballot measure, and I think we struck a good balance. And we've gotten so much overwhelming support for only just these few tweaks, and there is some language changes in there to make things really crisp and clear. I think it would really help the small businesses transition into this new paid sick leave requirement. So.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Klum. Before we go to invite testimony, I wanted to ask committee members, we have a suite of bills to moot the pending lawsuit on single subject, one of which is SB 80, which is before this committee. I should have brought it up earlier. I think members probably remember hearing that. Do you all want to go ahead and pass that bill out at this time? We have heard it, considered it. Senator Bjorkman's staff is here. If members have further questions, maybe we delay that to the end, but if members are ready to pass it, then we don't need to keep Senator Bjorkman's staff while we go through the public testimony on 161. Go ahead, Rep. Sadler.
No, I'm not. It's been a busy couple of days. I've not had a chance to renew that, so I would object to passing a bill of that import on a whim.
Okay, tell you what. We will try to wrap up 161 and then return to SB 80 and to Senator Bjorkman's staff. If y'all need to go, I will try to summarize and see if members can get comfortable and pass that out. I know it's late, but it did occur to us that we should get that done. Okay, so at this time, why don't we go to invited testimony. Is Katie Capozzi online for HB 161?
Hello.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ms. Capozzi. We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Co-chairs Hall and Fields and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, my name is Katie Capozzi and I serve as the President and CEO of the Alaska Chamber. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 161, which is a vital correction to the paid sick leave mandates that were passed through Ballot Measure 1 in last year's general election. The Alaska Chamber is the state's largest statewide business advocacy organization. Our mission is to promote a healthy business environment in Alaska. The Chamber has more than 700 members and represents businesses of all sizes and industries from across the state, representing 58,000 Alaskans and over $5 billion in wages. I'd first like to reinforce the point that the legislature does, in fact, have broad powers to amend initiatives, and the Alaska Chamber strongly encourages you to take leadership and use your granted authority to fix the most harmful elements found within the ballot measure. In the last 5 years, our small business owners, especially those in the tourism and hospitality industries, have gone through more economic hardships and survived curveballs than we could have ever imagined. And almost all of those hardships have been for reasons completely beyond our control. We had a global pandemic, we had workforce shortages, sky-high inflation, and we have a new added bonus this year of tariffs, which come along with a ton of uncertainty and price impacts, cost increases. So this committee and the legislature can't do anything about those circumstances, but you can amend this ballot measure and you can bring the relief that our small businesses desperately need. So while maybe well-intentioned or maybe not, Ballot Measure 1 introduced a one-size-fits-all mandate that failed to account for Alaska's unique economic landscape, diverse business community, and regional realities. In our conversations with members, just kind of echoing what Representative Klum just mentioned, in our conversations with members and non-members across the state since the passage of the ballot measure, it's become clear that many voters did not understand the true and full implications of the ballot measure. This, of course, is true for most ballot measures. However, this isn't just anecdotal. In the Alaska Chamber's most recent public opinion survey, which was just conducted last week, with the results being delivered to me actually just this morning, we found that 40% of Alaskans, and these were likely Alaska voters, by the way, that were our respondents, did not know that mandated paid sick leave, paid sick leave was included in the ballot measure. When asked if they would support or oppose a paid sick leave exemption for employers with fewer than 50 employees, 58% of respondents said that they would support the exemption. I will have much more detail on that information in that data set when I present to all of you next week when I'm in Juneau, and I'm looking forward to that. So why is an exemption needed? There are duplicative compliance measures for employers who already offer comprehensive paid sick leave and paid time off that has already caused a lot of confusion among businesses of all sizes. because of record keeping and administrative complications for small and medium-sized employers. I've heard lots of people suggest that it's a simple little tweak in your Quicken file, your QuickBooks file, and that is not true. And then operational disruptions caused by inflexible accrual and usage standards, especially as it relates to our seasonal and hospitality businesses. The Alaska Chamber supports HB 161 because it introduces critical guardrails and clarifications that allow businesses to comply with the spirit of paid sick leave while reducing regulatory overreach and economic harm. The key improvements include support small businesses by helping reduce compliance burdens on Alaska's smallest businesses, recognizes seasonal work realities by exempting seasonal employers whose operations peak 6 months or less. That does not address, by the way, all the issues of all seasonal employees, but it largely captures most of it. It clarifies sick leave definitions, which is something that we've heard a lot about from all of our members, allows flexibility for employers and employees, so permits the options for employees to cash out unused sick leave, prompting flexibility and allowing workers to benefit from unused leave time. It encourages voluntary compliance over mandates. As an organization that celebrates and advocates for free enterprise, we think that employers should step into the space. They know what it's going to take to attract employees, and so they should be able to set the policies that attract the employees that they need. Preserves jobs and growth, and protects rural and remote businesses. These are very common sense reforms that restore balance to Alaska's leave policies and support a healthy business environment. So we urge your support for this bill, which fixes some of the flaws in ballot measure one, definitely not all of them, supports our small businesses at a time where they could really use your help, and acknowledges and reflects Alaska's unique economic landscape. Thank you for your consideration. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Capozzi. Next up in invited testimony, not seeing any questions, is John Weddleton. Go ahead, Mr. Weddleton.
Hi, afternoon, everyone. And I am here to speak in support of the modifications to ballot measure one that are in House Bill 161. And I will tell you about that in just a moment, because first I want to tell you that my business is celebrating 41 years now. And we have had paid time off for over 20 of those. And we increased it during COVID and kind of rejuggled how we offer it. So I think paid time off has worked well for my business. The new plan, if I switch the entire company to a new plan, I'd actually save them some amount of money. We do it a little bit different, but a little bit more generous. But I'm able to do that with my business because we are 41 years old. And in our first 10, 15, or 20 years, all our money got plowed back into the business and getting the business going. And things like this would have really been difficult for us. It would have sapped a lot of the, you know, money and energy that we needed to keep it going. And that's why the cap, you know, at 50, I think is very helpful, because most businesses are very small, very fragile, and you've got to take that into consideration when we, you know, make laws like this. I give it some thought to, you know, probably most businesses in Alaska are less than 50, and does that remove the impact of this paid time off? And I actually think that when we make laws like this, it kind of plants a pole and says, this is the community expectations. So even businesses that, like mine, that are under 50, that kind of sets a standard that, you know, you're expected to get paid time off if you can. So it really does move the needle towards more paid time off. So it's not eliminating it at all. I also really appreciate the making it clear that we can employees can cash out their paid time off. I mean, some of mine, they don't get sick, and we let them go up to 120 hours, but they'd rather cash it out, so we allow that. And with the current wording, I would not allow that, because it doesn't say I can. I'm very nervous I'd get in trouble if I did. So that would take away what's really some of my employees consider a benefit. So I do support this. I appreciate it, and hope you will support it as well. Thank you.
Okay, good. Are there questions for either Mr. Weddleton or Ms. Capozzi? Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. My question is for Ms. Capozzi. I seem to have a recollection back when the ballot measure was still in campaign mode. I have this recollection of reading in the ADN that the chamber was not actively campaigning against ballot measure one. Am I remembering that correctly? And if so, what was going on back then that that you were choosing as a state chamber to take a step back?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Hall. We were the lead organization advocating for the ballot measure's defeat. So I'm not sure what you might be referencing. I know, you know, at the beginning of last year, we had a very robust discussion as a board as to how much we were going to enter the fray, but we had a position of opposition for more than a year before the vote. So we were definitely the lead agency, if you will, in attempting defeat.
Through the chair or co-chair, Ms. Capozzi, thank you. I'll do some research and see where my mind is failing me. Thank you.
Hey, Chair.
Yes.
Again, I just chime in. I think the Anchorage Chamber was on that position, but the Alaska Chamber has been in opposition for a long time. Okay. Yeah. I think you're thinking of the Anchorage Chamber.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Capozzi and Mr. Welton, for appearing and invited testimony. We will return to this bill at a later date. We have a couple. Yes.
Chair Fields, apologies. We do have one additional invited testifier. Ms. Davis has been online.
Oh, okay. I apologize for that. It looks like Regina Davis. Please proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name's Regina Davis, and I represent Davis Bluff and Concrete. A family-owned business based in Kenai. For over 50 years, we've supplied concrete products to support construction projects across our state, employing local Alaskans and contributing to our communities. I'm here today to express my strong support for House Bill 161, which addresses critical challenges facing small businesses like ours. HB 161 is a practical solution that balances worker protections with the realities of running a small business in Alaska's unique economy. HB 161 mitigates the overly burdensome paid sick leave requirements imposed by Ballot Measure 1. As a small business with 25 full-time employees and fluctuating seasonal hires, the current mandate to provide paid sick leave to every worker, including temporary staff, strains our finances and administrative resources. HB 161 raises the threshold to businesses with 50 or more employees. Additionally, this bill supports Alaska's seasonal economy, which is vital for businesses like ours. Many of our projects ramp up in the summer and rely on seasonal workers who may only be with us for a few months. Requiring paid sick leave for these workers creates administrative challenges and costs that do not align with the temporary nature of their roles. HB 161's exemption for seasonal employees ensures we can continue hiring locally during these critical periods, supporting our workforce and broader economy. The sick leave mandates would hurt businesses like ours. We are already struggling to find and retain workers, especially the temporary ones. We can't afford workers to be accumulating sick leave, then quit, and then come back and demand, you know, that they were gone for 6 days. I feel like it would also force us to raise our prices or cut jobs, negatively impacting our customers or, you know, prices. And I will have to echo with a lot of others here about everything that our small businesses have been through in the past 5 years. This is just another layer that I believe a bureaucracy that I believe that is just going to increase pricing and everything. So in closing, I urge you to support HB 161. It's a thoughtful fix that listens to our small business owners and respects Alaska's economic landscape. Thank you for your time and consideration and the needs of the businesses, small businesses like ours. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Davis. Not seeing additional questions, thank you, Representative Ruffridge and Representative Cologne, for presenting today. I would hope that Mr. Jackson and Ms. Bieber could come up and summarize SB 80 for Representative Sadler.
Mr. Chair, just yes. Briefly before I go, I know that this bill was scheduled for public testimony today, and I think there was a number of folks online waiting to testify. And I want to apologize to those folks online listening that it seems like we're not going to take that up today, but I will certainly be in contact with individuals as we reschedule that, hopefully,
yeah,
Mr. Chair.
I apologize. I think we canceled public testimony given the late start and being behind, so I apologize for that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Jackson and Ms. Bieber, thank you for being here. So I know other members had bills at the start of the hearing. SB 80 is a bill that we had heard, considered. It's part of a suite of bills to moot the single subject lawsuit. And Mr. Jackson and Ms. Bieber, could you just briefly summarize SB 80 again? Sorry for keeping you here late.
Oh, thank you. For the record, my name is Sabea Bieber, and I am staff to Senator Bjorkman. He apologizes for not being able to make it today. He had some prior obligations he had to attend. Senate Bill 80 is a cleanup bill from last year. It backdates and then extends the sunset date of four boards: the Board of Massage Therapy, the Marijuana Control Board, Alaska Commission on Aging, and the Big Game Commercial Services Board. All four of the 2023 board audits concluded that the board operated in the public's interest by actively amending regulations, conducting meetings in an effective manner, and enhancing public safety.
Okay.
And I can, sorry, through the chair, I can also let you know how long they're being extended if you'd like to know that.
Do members want to know that? Members don't want to know that. Okay. If there aren't further questions, why don't we pass this bill, Representative Hall?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Co-Chair, I move to report SB 80 version 34-LS0416/N out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Are there objections? Not seeing any Senate Bill 80 is reported from committee. And perhaps our staff can pass around the paperwork while we do the final item of business, which is hearing from two Board of Nursing appointees, Cheryl Payne and Marianne Murray. Ms. Payne and Ms. Murray, sorry that this meeting got started late, and there was a bunch on the agenda. Ms. Payne, if you can hear us, please go ahead and provide your testimony.
Yes, I can hear you through the chair.
Go ahead with your testimony. Thank you.
Through the chair and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to introduce myself. My name is Cheryl Jane Payne. I do go by CJ. I was born and raised in Seattle, Washington. After graduating high school in 1985, I went to work for the Boeing Company, Commercial Airplanes Division, and worked there through 1992. In 1992, I began working for Alaska Airlines as a flight attendant, and in 1993, I was transferred to the newly formed Anchorage base. In 94, I got married. We had a big game guiding business, a flying service, and a fishing lodge. These businesses gave me access to the true greatness and diversity of Alaska. I developed a deep love for our great state. As the years have gone by and my career with Alaska Airlines continues, I'm now in my 33rd year. I have had many, many opportunities to ask for medical assistance from nurses and doctors for in-flight medical emergencies. I'm always in awe of those who come forward to assist. I now have two elderly parents, both in their 86th year, and we are now navigating all of the associated medical challenges involved in elderly care. These experiences have made me deeply interested in giving back to the nursing community. It's my sincere hope that through being a member of the Board of Nursing, that I can assist in advocating for nurses and support their professional development through ensuring that there's adequate resources, training, and support systems in the nursing field. Commitment to quality care is another passion. I am dedicated to ensuring high standards of nursing practice and patient safety. Quality care is an absolute must in improving health outcomes for all of our communities. In my short time on the Board of Nursing, I do see that it's important to foster cooperation among nurses, educators, and the regulatory bodies. I believe that having diverse representation, as in this public seat, is important. It's been exciting to witness all that the board does. I intend to engage and listen to concerns regarding nursing practices. I do realize how important the public comment time is during our quarterly meetings in shaping nursing policies. And in closing, I'm deeply appreciative of your time and your consideration, and I hope that I can continue to represent the public seat on the Board of Nursing, and I'm eager to continue to contribute in a meaningful way. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Are there questions for Ms. Payne? Not seeing any. Thank you again, Ms. Payne, for testifying. Next up is Marianne Murray. Ms. Murray, please proceed with your testimony. Ms. Go ahead, Ms. Murray. We can hear you loud and clear.
Good afternoon, Chairs Fields and Halls, and esteemed members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. My name is Marianne Murray, and I'm here with you today with an unwavering commitment to the health and well-being of the people of Alaska and a profound desire to contribute to the excellence of the nursing profession by serving on the Alaska Board of Nursing. For over 32 years, I've been a nurse in many areas of practice, such as emergency room, nursing administration, flight nursing, and nursing education. For 14 years, I've been a proud member of Alaska's nursing community, working as a faculty member and the director of nursing at both UAA and now at Alaska Pacific University. In 2019 and 2020, I also served as the executive administrator for the Alaska Board of Nursing during the pandemic. In these capacities, I've witnessed firsthand the dedication, resilience, and crucial role that nurses play in every corner of our vast and unique state. Alaska nurses are the backbone of our healthcare system, providing compassionate care, advocating for patients, and upholding the highest standards of practice. My experiences have instilled in me a profound respect for the complexities and challenges faced by nurses in Alaska. I understand the unique logistical hurdles, the cultural training required, and the critical need for a well-supported and highly competent nursing workforce. It is this understanding, coupled with my commitment to high-quality nursing education, which motivates me to seek a position on this esteemed board. Serving on the Alaska Board of Nursing is not just a professional aspiration for me. It is a deeply felt responsibility. I am prepared to dedicate my time, energy, and expertise to this crucial role. And I am confident that my passion for nursing, my understanding of the Alaska healthcare landscape, and my commitment to ethical and effective governance will allow me to make a meaningful contribution to the board's important work. Thank you for considering my appointment to the Board of Nursing.
Thanks, Ms. Murray. Are there questions for Ms. Murray? Not seeing any. Thank you again, Ms. Murray, for being here. I just wanted Representative Sadler actually has a question if Ms. Murray is online.
I'm sorry, this was whom again speaking? I think I...
Marianne Murray. No questions?
I said no.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Okay. Thank you again, Ms. Murray. There are no questions. Before we adjourn, I just wanted to make sure the committee was aware. So we will not have a meeting on Monday, on Wednesday, because we have to hear from a number of appointees in addition to the other committee work. We'll start at 9, I think probably meet for an hour, recess, and then reconvene at 3:15. And we'll do the same thing on Friday just to make sure we have time to get through the appointees. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why are we not meeting on Monday?
I believe that a number of members may be absent on Monday, so that's why.
And why are we not meeting Friday?
For the same reason. Okay.
Other legislative duties, no doubt.
We are adjourned at 6:05.